97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Fred, I'm a little disappointed that Sue is not here for a variety of reasons, but I do like picking bumper songs like this one out for her. Although you would probably appreciate this one.
Oh, yeah, Christopher Cross.
Early 1980s. Chris Cross, Ride Like the Wind. I like this one as a bump. Sue, I think, will be back tomorrow because she has informed us that she's been released from jury duty, even though at first she said she was relaxed from jury duty, but she corrected herself. So that's good. It was like a one-day thing. She'll be here tomorrow afternoon. Unfortunately, I think both of us will be gone on Friday, and I've recommended Fred maybe takes Friday off, too, just to complete the trifecta. But Sue has to be out of town, and apparently so do I. I kind of ran down that story yesterday. I screwed something up with my schedule. And, you know, I always have to preface this when I talked to my friend Kevin, where I was confused about this weekend. We're taking my daughter hunting in Howard County. And I started the conversation with him saying, you know, I wish I could tell you this is not a pattern in my life where I screw things up with dates and times. But it does happen, Fred. And you've been with me all these years doing that. And this is one that's confusing. I don't really know how I did it, but I did it. Steve Jervey's coming up a little bit later this hour. He is a retired meteorologist down in Tampa. Used to be here at KDNL, but also worked for many years at WFLA in Tampa. And that's where he lives. And he's going to report on Milton. Also, Alana Austin, who is a parent in the Kirkwood School District. Some concerns about one of her daughter's teachers. And someone who is being accused of being a Holocaust denier, the teacher. And we'll get into that from Nyfer Middle School. Couple things. Here's one topic here, Fred, for you on Bidenomics. You know that I have been well established as a pyro, right? I really enjoy burning things.
Yep.
And I've now that the fall has kicked in, you know, I don't do this as much, obviously, certainly in the summer, but when it gets cooler, and last night was an example, started a fire in the fire pit. I love being out there. I turned the audio for the football game on out there. And oh, by the way, how about the Royals beating the Yankees?
Oh, yeah, that was cool. Great.
So, you know, it's a situation where I got to get firewood. And I'm telling you, you know, like I get two stacks, okay? So how much would that cost, Fred? Do you have any concept on firewood?
$120.
Okay, that's
maybe
not
a bit
even
more.
Close. No.
Nope.
You want to try again? Two stacks.
My stack is usually like 100.
Okay. My stack apparently is a lot bigger because this was $370 for two stacks of firewood. Now, this has gone up considerably. I'm pretty sure that when I started this process with Jay, and by the way, great firewood. I'm not putting this on him because he's got costs, etc. But I think it was 320.
Hmm.
I mean, maybe 6-7 years ago. Okay,
right.
320, like 160 a stack is what I remember. I could go back and I could look at my Venmo probably, but that's $50. So what's the percentage increase on that? You know, that's 20% increase. Probably. I'm not good at math, Fred. I was kind of looking for you to step
no,
in there.
No,
just,
no, I
that was a complete
back.
Guess, by no. the way. But it seems like it's more than like a 3% increase for sure. So that was like, you know, that was a little stunning when you're looking at the cost. But I went and did it. And I'm just it's like literally burning money, Fred, if you think about it. Right.
Yeah,
because
you're right.
Now, and this is uncomfortable. I don't want to be thinking, and this is what sucks about the whole situation. And I texted Jay back. I said, yeah, that's Bidenomics. But I like to just kind of throw the wood into the fireplace and enjoy myself. Now I have to think about how much I'm putting in there because it's costing so much money.
Is it nicely stacked?
Oh, yeah. He does a good job. You know, when I was clean last night, you know what I found, though? I was this might have been two nights ago now that I think about it. I think it was Sunday night when I was burning out there. And I made sure I was getting rid of all the firewood debris out there and everything. Found a little frog out there, too. They like to live behind the little, you know, moist area amongst the firewood. This was a story for Ethan as he joins us. This is quick. It's not going to mean much to most people, but this is weird. And I'm just wondering if it happened to anyone else. Because, Fred, you don't play fantasy football. I don't mean to leave you out in this conversation.
No, it's okay.
Sue loves fantasy football. She's going to be so disappointed that she's not here because she asks me all the time how my teams are doing. Ethan, I swear to God, I haven't told you about this.
Okay.
Yesterday, I start getting text messages in the morning about a live Yahoo football draft for a new league that I'm in.
Okay.
I didn't sign up for any league, and keep in mind, we're 5 weeks into the season.
Weeks in.
So this draft went on, and apparently was on auto draft, and now when I open my Yahoo app, so I have two teams on Yahoo and one on NFL Fantasy, and they actually kind of make it easy for you on the app because you can see all your teams. When I now open my fantasy football app, I see three teams, including the new one that I just got in. How would that even happen? I mean, that has to be some sort of Yahoo. At first, I thought it was a hack. but I'm not giving up any information. But, hey, I have a hell of a team. I got Brock Purdy. I got Antonio Brown, although he's hurt right now. Man, I got Davante Adams. There's a couple of these guys I think I have on my other teams. But that was just weird. And I was suspicious that it was a hack at first, but I don't even know how to get rid of it at this point.
My best theory is that Alexa logged onto your iPad, and she got curious and said she was going to join her own team.
That's not a bad theory now that I think about it.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
Not today. Brought to you by Fred.
Well, thank you.
Wait, I should say, brought to you by...
How about old Fred Bottenheimer over there, ladies and gentlemen?
There, thank you, Kenny Wallace.
I like that. How was Kenny last hour?
He was great. You know, he's always great. I did mention, though, you know, one thing I remembered here just last week, we always do, Kenny and I always do a baseball game. We've done it for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years now at this point. And we didn't do it this year. And it's on me because I lost interest, Fred. It's terrible, but I'm just being honest.
I imagine when you go to a baseball game with Kenny Wallace, it's like going with the entire stadium. Because everyone knows him, and he'll talk to everyone.
He will talk to everyone, yeah.
I also... go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I wanted to point out also, if you're watching on the Twitter stream, it says Fred's News, brought to you by the Hall of Famer.
Oh, I like that.
I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So let's start off with some sad news. Baseball legend, in my mind, Louis Tiant, has died at the age of 83. Now, I don't know if a lot of people remember him. He was a pitcher for Boston that had this really unique corkscrew sort of...
Like a sidearm, weird sidearm thing, though, right?
He'd always face center field. He'd swing around backwards. Because I remember as a kid watching him on the Saturday baseball game of the week.
Absolutely.
And I just loved watching him pitch. He died at the age of 83. He never made it into the Baseball Hall of Fame. But in 1968... You know, that was the year that Gibson had the 1.12 ERA. He had a 1.60 ERA. So he and, you know, Bob Gibson were part of the reasons that they lowered the mound.
Freddie Lynn tweeted out today. I love Fred Lynn, by the way. Even though I'm not a Red Sox fan, I have so much deep appreciation for the baseball history. He said, today is a very sad day. My friend and teammate Louis Tiant passed away. A big game pitcher, a funny, genuine guy who loved his family and baseball. I miss him already. RIP, my friend. But yeah, I think anyone who grew up in that era, just because you can automatically flash back, at least I can, to him on the mound in that style of pitching. And by the way, he was the son, I didn't know this, he was the son of a star in the Negro Leagues. His dad was a great baseball player as well.
What amazes me about Louis Tiant, played 18 years in the league, and you look at these numbers, and these are really good numbers. And if a guy like this in today's age of baseball put up these numbers, almost 3,500 innings pitched, just under 2,500 strikeouts, 229 career wins, a career 3.3 ERA. In today's day and age, you don't see even that anymore.
Yeah, that's a Hall of Famer.
So, I mean, if we saw someone in today's day and age of baseball do that, no doubt Hall of Famer.
By the way,
no doubt.
He said this to ESPN Deportes. This goes back a while, in August 2008. He said, I think I deserve to be in Cooperstown, but I have something to say to those who elect me. If you don't take me in life, don't try to elect me after I die, please. There you go. Hey, I mean, I get it.
Yeah, nothing worse about than a posthumous award. Let's go to today in history, and another baseball one. Today in history, October 8th, 1956, 66 or 68 years ago, Don Larsen pitched the only perfect game in a World Series to date. Here's some of that
sound. Larsen is ready, gets the sign. Two strikes, ball one. Here comes the pitch. Strike three. A no-hitter, a perfect game for Don Larsen.
Wow.
Yankees beat the Dodgers 2-0. That was game 5 of the World Series in 56. And Don Larsen began his career as a member of the St. Louis Browns.
Really?
He was with the Browns in 1953. And then when they were sold to Baltimore, he became one of the Baltimore Orioles. Then he went on to be a member of the Yankees.
Playoff baseball is so, it's so exciting, so electric as it is. I cannot imagine being in attendance for a perfect game in October. That is just, that's chills, just the thought of hearing that call.
There have been three in Major League Baseball postseason.
Three perfect games or no hitters?
No hitters.
Okay.
I mean, Don Larsen's was one.
Right.
Roy Halladay.
Roy Halladay had one in 2010. And then there was a combined one for the Astros in 2022.
That doesn't count, though.
In the playoffs.
Yeah, it's the Astros.
I mean, it's not, well, you know, yeah, they combined. Cheated.
Yeah,
right.
They cheated that one year, so nothing counts.
They were banging on garbage cans to get that no-hitter.
And I've told this story before. I was in Chicago at Wrigley Field, and I think the Cubs had a no-hitter going up until maybe the eighth inning.
You were texting me that.
Yeah.
This was just a couple of years ago, or last year.
And it was just a typical Cubs mess up. But one hit went right in front of home plate, and the pitcher and catcher ran into each other.
Oh.
And neither of them touched the ball, but they ruled it a hit.
Cubs
I was
Cub.
At a Sonny Gray. He went 6 2/3, I think, with no hits. And then I think the Cardinals even lost that game. But, you know, you always sit there, and then nobody's supposed to talk about it, right? The announcers don't want to mention it. But you start looking at the scoreboard, and you're like, wait a second. Although this year it was mainly the Cardinals had no hits. We're not looking up there.
Birthdays today, we've got Bruno Mars is 39.
Hey, 39?
39.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. I think my favorite is Grenade. I really like that song a lot.
It's a great song.
Yeah. Chevy Chase is 81. And here's a clip of him from his movie Caddyshack.
The Zen philosopher Basho once wrote, "A flute with no holes is not a flute. And a donut with no hole is a Danish."
Sarah Nobody, like,
he's
what else
got
can
the,
you say about
he's
him?
He's got the worst reputation as a human being, but he's damn funny, right?
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, two nights ago, I walked into my house and Caddyshack was on the TV, so I was watching some of it.
Another birthday today, Jesse Jackson is 83, and I have a clip of him from 1988, his speech at the Democratic National Convention.
We must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive.
Now, yeah, as big of a race baiter as he was, he you know, pales in comparison to modern-day race baiters. That's what I'd say about Jesse Jackson.
The reason I bring him up is because I know, Mark, you always have you've got two famous people you've met at the urinal.
Yes. I mentioned this yesterday, Ray Liotta and Walter Payton.
Right. I've met two famous people in an elevator. Jesse Jackson rode up in an elevator with him, and the Commodore's Lionel Richie.
Jesse Jackson at KMOX. Both of them were at KMOX?
No, Jesse Jackson was in Kansas City at a convention.
Rode
up with him.
Just randomly. Did you talk to him?
Him and his bodyguards. No, they were so big. Everybody on the elevator was huge.
See, I had a good elevator encounter with... I'm separating my elevator encounters, Fred, from my urinal encounters, all right?
Okay.
But I had a great elevator encounter. Well, I had two, really. One with Al Pacino. You remember that one from a couple years ago?
Yeah.
That was for The Irishman. And then one time I took my son out to Hollywood. We were at the pool at the Four Seasons because that's where they put us up, the fancy place. And we get on in Lyle Lovett's on there with this woman who is more beautiful, if you can believe this, than Julia Roberts. Remember, he had dated Julia Roberts. Stunning. And I said, Mr. Lovett, and I introduced him to my son because my son had no idea who he was. He was very pleasant, but that was a cool encounter.
That is neat. Huh.
Man.
Are you watching the Oprah special tonight?
I think I'm going to.
This is the one. It's called The Presleys, Elvis, Lisa Marie, and Riley. And Riley is the granddaughter of Elvis.
Riley Keough.
Right, Lisa Marie Presley's daughter. She was talking with Oprah, and one of the stories that she told is that in the book that her mom wrote that she finished, Lisa Marie kept her son Ben's body at home on dry ice for months after his suicide.
She had experienced a lot of loss early on in her life, and I think a lot of her life was dictated by that and by grief.
Okay, that's kind of weird.
Isn't that bad?
Wild.
That one's weird.
One of the other segments is when Oprah and Riley go through some of Elvis's things.
Where are all these things, like, archived here?
Just out in the back.
Just out in the back, yeah.
This Bible.
Yes.
Was
his Bible? Oh, this is precious.
No. I think it says 1957.
1957.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then this is Elvis's black box, mm-hmm. which was basically like his purse.
Really? What's in here?
And he would travel with it everywhere, and we can look inside it. It was just his sort of most personal things, and nothing's been touched.
So, oh my gosh, look at this.
Crazy?
His Amex card. His Amex card expired 572. It says Elvis Presley. Wow, that is cool.
But I'll admit, and Sue's in this camp too, Jane as well, we talked about this on Friday, I have a fascination with Elvis. I think a lot of us do. I'll watch tonight, or I'll record it, watch a little baseball, and I'm going to check it out.
And Enterprise Center is celebrating a milestone today. It's 30 years since it opened its doors. It's sold 5 million hot dogs in the, over the 30 years. You line that up end to end, it would go from here to Atlanta. Let's see.
When that place opened, though, wasn't one of the...
It was the Kiel Center.
Right, but I mean, wasn't part of the controversy about the purple seats?
Oh, yeah.
That, like, a big deal for a while?
Yeah,
it was like, what the hell?
It looks so much better now.
Thank God.
Well, the renovations were really good.
Thank the Lord.
That's right. And you could actually fit the old arena inside the Enterprise Center.
Oh, wow.
Can
the
you
Enterprise
really?
Is that big.
And Ethan, you never went to the old... you're too young for the old arena, the Checkerdome, but that place was just
What year was, I guess, 30 years ago.
30 years ago.
I wasn't alive 30 years ago.
But so on the 1994.
On the 30th anniversary, the Blues opening up their season playing right now.
This afternoon, an afternoon game out in Seattle. Isn't that weird?
On the regular season?
Yep, first game today.
The first game.
Apparently, I'm
underway.
Not playing or paying much attention.
No score after one.
Who has played the Enterprise Center the most? The Trans-Siberian Orchestra has had 36 performances since 2000.
Well, that makes sense because Al Petrelli and the gang, they come in, they I don't know, seven shows every Christmas,
I went for the first time last year. Boy, is that a show.
Fred and
I
have been.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. The highest grossing concert in Enterprise was Zach Bryan's concert this past May. The first ticketed event there was an NBA exhibition game between the Chicago Bulls and the Washington Bullets. And the first ticketed concert was Billy Joel's, who's been there six times.
Cool. Nice.
Bon Jovi had the biggest crowd for a concert back in 2011. So there you go.
I was at that show.
Oh, wow.
The only time I've seen him.
You were a part of history.
I was way up. That was a big crowd. I was way up, like in one of those suites in the back of the arena. He looked like an ant.
And finally, in Sue's News, today's random fact. When Diet Coke debuted in 1982... It seems like it's been longer than that, but since in 1982.
Well, because late 70s, like I remember battling with my mom about the RC Cola and the Pepsi, and it wasn't like a Diet Coke thing at that point.
You're right. It was the first time Coca-Cola ever used the word Coke on any of its products. Up until then, everything was just Coca-Cola. They never had, it wasn't just called
Coke.
That's
interesting.
So
just
Diet
in and of itself.
Coke was the first time, 1982.
There you go. Does that wrap Fred's news?
That does it.
Nice job, Fred.
Thank
I like
you very
it.
Much.
We have been informed by the courts that Sue has been released from jury duty, should be back tomorrow. Interesting case from the Kirkwood schools involving an accusation that one of their middle school teachers is a Holocaust denier. We'll get to that. Well, they ain't playing around with Milton down in Florida. And Sue Thomas's friend, Steve Jervy, who has been a great hurricane correspondent for us, is going to visit with us here in about 10 minutes for the very latest. He's down in Tampa. He's been there for 25 years. Used to be here at KDNL for a stretch in the 90s. So some of you might remember, I shared a story in August, right when school was starting, about a situation at Nifer Middle School in Kirkwood. And it dealt with a teacher that had a Palestinian flag that was in his classroom, middle school teacher, a parent approached him and said, hey, why not, have the Israeli flag in there? And then the conversation got very strange. And I tried to shed some light on this story for a while, and I think I achieved that. But then things kind of got quiet. And I heard over the weekend from Alana Austin, who's the parent that raised some of these concerns, and she told me she was prepared to discuss some of this. So, Alana, welcome to the program. How are you this afternoon?
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. I really appreciate you being patient during this quiet period.
Well, I guess I expected that maybe some lawyers got involved, et cetera, and I wasn't sure what the whole story was, but I do think it's an important story to share. I really do.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So part of it is, I gave the district my word that I would not go to the media while they were kind of conducting this proper investigation. And they concluded it last week with no result. And so I said, you know what? I've held up my end of the bargain. I think it's time to make this story a little bit bigger. It didn't have to be so messy. It didn't have to be so public. This teacher, Jason Kipp, he actually was also employed at Eureka teaching football, and they did the right thing from the very beginning. Meanwhile, Kirkwood has done nothing. So, here I am to speak on behalf of Jewish students, students of color. Really, it's kind of crazy how poorly it's
been. Yeah, it really is. And let's give a little background here. So Jordan Palmer, who I had on the air, did a great accounting of this in the Jewish Light in August. I didn't see any other coverage outside of maybe one television story, and I highlighted this quite a bit. But if you can kind of go through what happened on August 14th, Alana.
Sure. Yeah, so August 14th, it was back to school night, curriculum night, where only the parents come in to meet all of the teachers that their students will have that year. And so there are two Jewish families in eighth grade, and the other Jewish family was in, you know, Mr. Kipp's classroom. They saw the flag. They approached him. They asked if he would hang an Israeli flag, and, you know, kind of very gruffly was like, no, that's your version of history, which is such a bizarre response.
Yes.
And so, you know, there's like probably a 15, 20 minutes during which Jason had time to think of a better response. So, you know, my husband and I come into the classroom, and of course, again, see this Palestinian flag and calmly approached him and just said, you know, hi, no flag should be a symbol of hate, but this really has become kind of a call to the end of Israel, to death to Jews. We are Jews. We're Holocaust, you know, the descendants of Holocaust survivors. Would you also consider hanging an Israeli flag?
And he, by the way, that seemed like a pretty, in you know, when you think of the whole scenario, that seemed like a pretty polite request.
I mean, I thought so, right? Like, here's a teacher. I don't know him. There's no reason to argue. I'm trying to, like, seek to understand. Maybe he really doesn't understand. Like, maybe he doesn't know, although he's a history teacher, right? The symbolism of all of this. Just said no.
Yeah, but then when you say, look, we're descendants of Holocaust survivors, and you hope that he would reconsider, that's when it really takes a turn, right?
Yes. I said, you obviously don't know us. You know, we are the descendants of Holocaust survivors. And he said, well, that's your version of history. And I kind of stood back and I repeated his words back to him and said, did you just say that the Holocaust is my version of history? And he said, yeah, that's one version of history. And, you know, other parents are witnessing this and they're obviously shocked and concerned and confused that a teacher is saying this in front of other people. And so I said, okay, we're going to continue this conversation with a principal. And he said, no, ma'am, we're not. And that was those are the last words I've heard from him since August 14th.
So you shared that with Beth Ruta, who is the eighth grade level principal. And she says, look, write this stuff down, which is one of the reasons you kind of remember the accounts, because you wrote all this down and you wrote letters, right?
Right. Immediately, she was very responsive, and she just said, I don't want to misrepresent what you and the other Jewish family heard. Please write this down basically immediately. She said, I'll wait up for you. So we did. So, yes, to your point, that's why I'm able to. And I think when someone is a Holocaust denier and says something so jarring to you, it's hard to forget. And so we wrote it down. And, you know, the next day they were like, great news. We're pulling the Jewish kids out of class. This is part one of the plan. Great. Perfect. Part one suggests that there's going to be part two and part three. Yeah. And
how about part two, removing the Holocaust denier from the Kirkwood School District? That would be my part two, right?
Well, I think you know what part two is, which is like, I'm like mortified to even say it out loud because it's so embarrassing on behalf of Kirkwood Schools. Their part two was for us to sit around in a circle and pass a stuffed animal around and talk about our hurt feelings.
Okay, now we're going to focus on this, Alana, because this is unbelievable. And I highlighted this. What do they call this whole thing? The what circle?
A restorative circle.
A restorative circle. And you had explained exactly what you had to do in that restorative circle.
Well, I didn't go because I'm not interested in talking about hurt feelings. I want to talk about facts and apologies.
But if you had sat in there, you legitimately hand a stuffed animal around, right?
Yeah, it's a bumblebee. So actually, I did buy myself a really beautiful bumblebee bracelet. But yeah, you pass a stuffed animal around, and you can only talk when you're holding the stuffed animal. And you have to talk about why someone's words hurt your feelings. That's it. That was their plan.
So the other thing that's important here, this is mind-blowing when you think about all this, but I want to make sure we get all the information out there, because this is not simply an allegation on your part. The dude apologized to Dr. Ruta, right? He actually says, I wasn't in the right headspace. So it's not like they're denying that this happened.
No, they are. No one is denying that it happened. No one has actually said that he's not a Holocaust denier. And that was one of the questions we had for Kirkwood, because this is not the first incident that Jason Kipp has of anti-Semitic behavior in the classroom. And there's been no explanation. There's been no apology. And that would have really stopped all this from being so public. If right the next day someone would have said, oh, my gosh, I didn't mean that. I didn't hear you. I wasn't listening. But no, I mean, other parents who heard this, they wrote in. Kirkwood says they've gotten thousands of emails about it. Kirkwood has pulled non-Jewish kids out of the class.
But that's it.
Because Right.
Yeah.
So if his classroom isn't safe for all, how is it safe for any? And what's the plan for next year? Are they going to guess which kids are Jewish? Help me understand how
this... Look, this should have never gotten this far. And I think you know that. And, I think people listening right now, and this is my response, is how in the hell can Kirkwood react this way? It is just stunning that they don't have more that they can offer in this situation. It really is. It's mind-boggling.
Well, and it gets worse, because 2 weeks ago, he actually followed my daughter down the hall, and there is video footage of it. Just picture a small eighth grade child and a larger man follows her down the hallway. But Kirkwood said that because he didn't say anything to her, it's not considered intimidation or retaliation.
That's ridiculous. Now, when this all started, I tried to assist in a way. We got the Attorney General's office at least to take a peek at this. Was there any follow through on that? And is there anything else that they can do, do you think?
So now that the investigation is over and Kirkwood has concluded nothing, I would love to talk to the Attorney General. I would love to talk to more people, because what happens next? Again, Jason Kipp has kind of this history of anti-Semitic behavior in the classroom. And if he is so bold to deny the Holocaust to parents during curriculum night, what is he teaching our children in the classroom?
Well, that's the bottom line is you shouldn't be teaching children in the classroom. But Alana, I got to go because we got to get a hurricane update this afternoon. But this is a fascinating story.
I appreciate it.
I'd like to shed more light on this. We're going to keep going. So keep me posted. You and I are going to talk separately as well. So thank you very much.
Of course. Thank you so much, Mark.
That's unbelievable. I mean, I can't imagine if that happened to me and I was a Jewish parent. She's being pretty calm, all things considered, in what that teacher said. And Kirkwood has a long history of shameful behavior, and this just fits the narrative, sadly. It's unreal. Well, I'm a little sad because Sue is off today, and she is the one who originally set us up with Steve Jervey, her friend who used to work here in St. Louis at KDNL, is down in Tampa, retired from WFLA. And Steve, at this point, I'm just going to let you take it, because holy moly, this is a hell of a storm heading your way, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. West coast of Florida, we don't typically we get late season storms in October because the cold fronts that bring cool air to St. Louis get farther south. And basically, if a storm's in the Gulf or the Caribbean, it tends to nudge it toward the west coast of Florida. And that's what's happening now. This upper level trough is pushing it toward the west coast. And those of us that live here, I live in the city of Tampa itself. I'm in a zone C. A and B have been ordered evacuations, and they'd be wise to go if worst case scenario would work out. But we're really all kind of watching where the storm is actually going to make landfall. It's strengthened at 5 o'clock, 4 p.m. Central, from the National Hurricane Center. It's strengthened to 165-mile-per-hour winds, and it's on an east to northeasterly track. And if you watch a storm and you see how the track goes, they kind of wobble. They don't always just make a straight line. So that's what it's doing. It's wobbled a little bit. That slowed it down a bit. So that kind of extends the agony of waiting for when the storm will actually make landfall. But roughly Thursday, early in the morning, maybe 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, most of the computer models suggest that. So that's what we're looking at here. And with this storm, you're going to hear a lot about it, but because the storm has weakened and then strengthened, and likely thanks to those upper level winds and that trough in the upper atmosphere that I mentioned, it'll probably weaken some more in terms of winds. Oh, it weakened to 100, and it's forecast to be 125 mile per hour winds at landfall. That sounds great. But the water that it's built up is already there.
Yeah.
That's not gone anyplace. So that's going to come ashore and be a massive storm surge problem for no matter where it's making landfall, south. So it landfalls in St. Petersburg, for example. South of there would be horrible because it's just pushing that water into the bay. If it goes a little farther south into, say, Sarasota, you look at the city of Sarasota and point south of that because this counterclockwise rotation just shoves that water on the coast. And we're looking at 10 to 15 feet of water above the normal tide or sea level there.
So I've only been to Tampa one time a few years ago. My sister and brother-in-law have a condo that they have there because he does business down there. But I remember being like on that Riverwalk area, et cetera. So is that an area that would be the water will just rush into that? And we're talking about the seawall there growing, and that area would be flooded immensely, I'm guessing?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, that Riverwalk you were on with the last storm, Helene, didn't even make landfall, was underwater.
Okay.
So that Riverwalk that you were strolling around, which that's actually on the Hillsborough River. That's fresh water that flows into the bay, salt water. So that's that water gets shoved up in and all the rivers that empty into Tampa Bay. The water just gets shoved back up into those rivers. So if you live along a river anywhere on the West Coast and you're in the wrong spot, that water just gets pushed all the way up and you flood.
Are the differences in zones A, B, and C just simply based on how far you are away from the water?
Yes, and of course, it's very flat here in Florida, and virtually no elevation. A lot of people live 2, 3, 4, 5 feet above sea level.
Right.
They're on the water. So you just raise that water up 10 feet, and you've got water. And a lot of people, you've seen it on the news 2 weeks ago, got hit hard with Helene along coastal areas, probably the worst in 100 years. 1921 is the latest reference point for a storm. But the flooding we had with that is the worst I've seen on the West Coast in my short time here, relatively 26 years. But yeah, since 1921, and now we have another storm coming that could probably bring even worse storm surge, no matter where it like makes landfall, which we don't know yet.
You know, and one of the things that I heard, you can confirm this, but it's not out of the question that you have two major hurricanes in a season, but it's very rare to have it like almost back to back, right? Within 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I always say. You can live in a place in Florida and not have a hurricane for 100 years, or you can live in a place in Florida and have two major hurricanes in 1 year. You know, so that's just how the nature of it is here, where the upper level patterns are, the way water temperatures are in the Caribbean and the Gulf. Late season, and the season peaks about September 10th, late season October is typically, historically, when we've seen the worst storms in 1921, 1848, those were the late season storms, because those cold fronts tend to shove those storms that develop in that warm water toward the West Coast.
You know, one of the things I said earlier, and I hope this is true, that I wonder if some of those people in zones A and B who might have been willing to sit this one or, you know, stay and not evacuate, saw North Carolina, Steve, and said, we ain't taking a chance on this one, because that devastation is just incredible. And I still don't think we've seen the depths of it.
No, we haven't. There's still, it's just incredible. I know we talked before that storm, but I had no idea of the amount of disaster that would occur with the flash flooding up in North Carolina. Just absolutely stunning. But they have the reference point just from 2 weeks ago. A lot of these same people, their homes have been basically run over with water, and they've had to put all their belongings out by the street. And a lot of that hasn't been picked up. That's going to become debris, perhaps, in some areas that have already been flooded just 2 weeks ago. They've lost their belongings. They're basically the first level of their house is you know, was filled with water and has to be all redone with drywall. So it's going to take a long time to recover. And there's a lot of debris laying in the streets right now from the people who pulled out of their house. And that's going to be moving around in this fast-moving water.
So if I'm a guy like you, or maybe if I'm not even a meteorologist, and this thing's going to make landfall at 2 a.m. in the morning on Thursday, I stay up to watch the coverage, right?
Yeah, a lot. I think many people will because of, you know, the uncertainty of it and the risk of it. A lot of people will not sleep until they lose power, perhaps.
Right.
But this is a very intense hurricane, and this is not, you know, a Category 2. This is, I don't want to scare people, or I've seen enough of that on TV lately. But it is a Category 5 at this point. It will likely weaken thanks to those upper level winds. But keep in mind, the water is already there. The gusts will be bad, yes, here locally where I live. But it's really going to be a water story, I think.
Yeah.
South of where that you'll see where that eye comes ashore, and south, that's where the water is going to pile up in already devastated areas. And that all went all the way down to Fort Myers Beach. They're forecasting 12 feet right now currently in Fort Myers Beach. So a lot of the West Coast will be affected.
Well, stay safe, Stephen. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. I know Sue's disappointed that she missed you, but we will we'll talk maybe after all this. So I appreciate it.
All right, Mark.
Take care. That's Steve Jervey, former meteorologist here in St. Louis, but also at WFLA in Tampa. That is just unreal. You know, I've said this before, is we certainly have tornadoes and severe weather here in the Midwest, but we don't have mudslides. Sure, again, an earthquake, I guess, but not as prone to those, and we don't have hurricanes. So I will take our weather here in the Midwest. If we have to trade the heat and humidity for no hurricanes, I think that would be a good thing. This one looks just awful. And I do think it's relatively important that people paid attention to the coverage in North Carolina, and maybe we'll save some lives because they're going to get out in Florida. So we'll keep you posted on all that, and I'm sure we'll have Mr. Jervy back in due time as well. Coming up in the next hour, back to some politics, Charles Lipson, our good friend, Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago. He's going to weigh in on some of the presidential race and beyond. And then Chris Elston, he's known as Billboard Chris, who has addressed the issue of this nonsense gender-affirming care. Actually went before the United Nations and gave a speech a couple weeks ago. Chris is going to join us at 525.
Get more at 971talk.com.